efforts by ulemas at seminaries and academic centers. Activities by laborers and entrepreneurs in the industrial sector and providing services to the people. So when you consider the revolutionary goals, you will learn about the examples for continuing this path. Efforts by young researchers and also efforts by activists providing social services, and also those who operate in the field of charity works and developments, and the people put on display their performance in this field. Also, those who are active in the field of defense and those who are active for the jihad of the depicting and delineation, and that was mentioned by Mr. Ali Hashem, and also the hardworking civil servants, the civil servants working at the three branches of the establishment, those who play an enlightening role in the field of politics. There are many who are shedding light on realities in the political sphere. Today we have this the public media, the cyberspace, and those who feel their responsibilities, they enlighten, make enlightenments, also by the IRI, by IRIB and the media, the press, assisting the centers of resistance, those who help the focal points of resistance in the region and the world of Islam, those are actually contributing to the continuation of the revolution. And also those who are prepared to engage in various events. For example, there is the issue of defending the holy shrines, and there are people engaging in such acts, and there are developments on 9th of day, and it was 8th of day in Tabriz. So these actions contribute to the continuation of the revolution. These are all components of a public move, a public movement that contributes to the continuation of the revolution that takes place while taking into account these lofty goals of the revolution. There are two types of such efforts. Some are related to the present day. Some are related to the future. Now, speaking of the current requirements, the people, the masses, will actually realize them, and they will promptly come to the scene. That was true about the Holy Defense. A point made by the late Imam led to the flowing of people towards the battlegrounds. And of course, people's vigilance is astonishing. Whenever needed, people enter the scene in a vigilant manner, and I can refer to people's presence in the war fronts, their presence for countering the anti-revolutionary elements. The event in Tabriz was what happened in Tabriz was an example, and there were other examples also. other activities such as Ninth of Day. The people came to the scene on their own, and also, the same is true about scientific activities needed by the people. For example, regarding the corona pandemic, scientists, our young scientists became active. And I was aware of their performance, and as soon as a decision was adopted to produce vaccines. You see, today we have produced different types of vaccines domestically, and we became needless of other countries. And they, of course, the foreigners did not give us the vaccines that we needed, so the most recent one was people's turnout and the 22nd of Bahman ceremonies, and this year's 22nd of Bahman was an astonishing one, and the people had a spontaneous presence on the scene, and it was really praiseworthy. The people are facing problems. There are problems related to coronavirus, and the people's livelihood, and also mud slinging by foreigners and some domestic elements helping them. So you see all these obstacles. Despite facing all these obstacles, the people have a massive turnout in the 22nd of Bahman rallies, and those who issue reports about people's participation every year they can approximately guess the number of people taking part, and they reported that in some provinces people's turnout was doubled, and in some areas it was 50% more compared to previous years. So such a turnout indicates people's awareness and vigilance. It's praiseworthy, and that move was quite a meaningful one. These are related to the needs of the present time, and the people have their own initiatives. And there are some issues related to the future. Many do actually realize them, but there are some who are negligent. So, by these needs, I mean, if you don't think about them today, if you don't do anything about them today, tomorrow, you will face problems tomorrow. If you don't do anything today, you will face problems tomorrow. For example, I can refer to the need for training scientists and researchers. If we do not train researchers, if we do not create a scientific movement today, in 15 or 20 years, we will fail to have prominent scientists that would be able to go beyond the scientific boundaries of the world. Also, another point is the need to increase the population. If this is a point I emphasize, if we don't do anything about it today, in 15 or 20 years, it's going to be too late. Then we will turn into a country that lacks the young population for progress. So Today we should think about tomorrow, or the issue of the of nuclear energy, and the world is becoming more dependent on nuclear energy on a daily basis. Sooner or later, we will have definite need to peaceful nuclear energy. If we do not pursue that path today, it's going to be late tomorrow, and we will be left empty-handed on that day when the world becomes dominant on all aspects of this issue. It's going to be problematic for us to take steps on that time. So you see the enemy front that is acting in an oppressive manner with respect to the nuclear energy, and they know it's a peaceful one, and they are imposing sanctions. And they are saying that they are making meaningless claims. They are uttering meaningless words, claiming that we are after a nuclear weapon. They know that we are just seeking to have peaceful use of nuclear energy. And they do not want the Iranian nation to attain such an outstanding scientific progress, because tomorrow the nation will be in need of this, and the enemies do not want this movement to continue. So, if we act in a negligent manner, we will face problems. We will face problems tomorrow. In 1394 and 1395 Iranian calendar, with respect to JCPOA, I mentioned certain points to be considered in the deal in order to prevent future problems. That was an objection I made at that time, and I said that certain points must be considered. Some of these points were overlooked and led to subsequent problems that you can all see. Therefore, an approach towards the future and becoming prepared for the future is of importance. Another important point I should mention is that in the past 4 decades since the victory of the revolution, many activities have been carried out for the continuation of the revolution, and these activities were effective ones. There were some spontaneous activities by the people. There were some activities carried out by the government, and the major tasks have been accomplished in the past decades, and some want to overlook these activities. We should not allow the present problems in the country to actually cover up the major activity. We should not allow the problems to cover up the major activities that have been carried out so far. We have had major breakthroughs and progress. One example is the progress made in the field of science. In the years after the revolution, we have made major scientific progress. We have surpassed all world countries. This has been mentioned by international circles and centers. Some have said that the progress has been tenfold. Some have said it's been 13-fold compared to the average progress at the global level. And science is the source of power, and in fact, this reminds one of the poem that science brings about ability and power for a country. So we have made scientific progress in various sectors, and the early days of the revolution one could not even consider perceive such progress. We were all present on the leading fronts of the revolution, so in the field of nuclear energy, biotechnology, technology, and various complicated medical and surgical operations, and major scientific arenas in the field of infertility and stem cells. We could not believe that we'll be able to make such progress. And thank God we have made progress, and our young people have made possible such breakthroughs. Another aspect is the country's infrastructure. Of course, I do not want to draw comparisons. Those who study statistics, they can draw such comparisons, and such comparisons are interesting and sweet. With respect to construction of highways and railways and construction of dam, housing, transfer of natural gas, water, electricity, we have made major breakthroughs in the past years. These such breakthroughs are astonishing. And in the absence of the revolution or revolutionary movements, we were not able to achieve such progress. I can refer to the health sector, and also we have become the focal point of medicine in the region. Those who had the money, they traveled abroad for a surgery. But you see, for the most complicated surgeries, there are people coming from regional countries traveling to Iran. And there has been more than tenfold increase in the progress made compared to the years prior to the revolution. The same is true about the economy. I do criticize ourselves in the economic area, also in the field of social justice, in the field of fair distribution of wealth, and the existence of underprivileged individuals. I do have criticisms, but economically speaking, based on judgment made by economic circles in the world, Iran has made considerable economic progress based on economic indices and indicators. Furthermore, we have become self-sufficient in the field of production. The self-reliance of Iranian producers and manufacturers, and IRIB has an important role to play in this regard to reflect such achievements. And so far, these achievements have not been properly reflected, and this is an obligation that has to be fulfilled by the IRIB. And these have all contributed to the independence of the revolution and its continuation, and of course there has been some laxity, but in some cases there may have been some ill intentions. So in the absence of such laxities, the situation would have further improved. So today, with the continuation of the revolution, thank God, the revolution is alive and is at the same time generative.
This
when you see the global arrogance countering this revolution, engaging in enmity, it is indicative of the fact that that the revolution is alive. Otherwise, the enemies would not have shown such a malicious approach. So, what do we mean by the revolution being alive? That means the new generations of the revolution that have strong bonds with the goals of the revolution. That means national independence, national dignity, national welfare, social justice, and realization of an Islamic society. And eventually, as I said, creating the modern Islamic civilization. These are the lofty goals pursued by this revolution, and the people have strong bonds with these goals, and the people will do whatever they can. And a majority of people in the country do pursue this path, and there may be a few who may be slow, but generally speaking, the people do pursue these lofty goals. The revolution is alive, and the people contribute to the continuation of the revolution, and one of the reasons, as you can see, is the hostility by the enemies, and that's been to the establishment's steadfastness. One can hear from some that the revolution has been distanced from its goals. That is not true. If the country had distanced itself from the goals of the revolution, the enemies would not have shown such hostilities. Such hostilities indicate that the country and the Islamic establishment have remained loyal to these goals and adhere to these goals. Some say, one can hear some saying that the establishment has been distanced from the goals of the revolution, and they want to show that they have bonds with the revolution. I do not accept this. I do not accept their having bonds with the revolution, because one who is having a luxurious life and has a luxurious approach, he cannot accept the slogan of supporting the oppressed, the underprivileged. Our slogan is the slogan of supporting the underprivileged and those who have a luxurious life. They cannot remain loyal to that slogan. Our slogan is countering the arrogance, countering the hegemonic moves and hegemonic powers. Those who talk of giving in to the hegemonic powers, those who speak of giving in or surrendering to the U.S., they cannot remain loyal to the goals of the revolution. So this is not acceptable. And we thank God for giving strength to this nation, for their steadfastness, and managed to bring the country to this point of progress. And God willing, this steadfastness will continue, not just inside the country, but also in the region. People's steadfastness has affected the region. You see, resistance movements in regional states are growing, and that has tarnished the image of the U.S. and the hegemonic powers, and the people of the region have become stronger, and they are speaking against the U.S. and their actions. We should attach importance to this and continue the path of the revolution. I recommend young people to detect the movements of the enemies to see what is pursued by the enemies. And young people should act in the opposite way. I believe that the enemy has targeted the people, the public opinion, the young people's thoughts. They are spending billions of dollars in their think tanks, they are making efforts in order to target the youths. They are pursuing two aspects. One is economic pressures in order to put more pressure on the people in order to distance them from the Islamic establishment. And the other aspect is mudslinging, just leveling allegations and they target the foundations of the revolution and the centers that are effective for the revolution's progress, including the parliament, the constitutional council, the IRGC. Today they are targeting and mudslinging, targeting the IRGC, and also our great martyr, Martyr Soleimani. If they did not fear if they did not fear people's reaction, they would have also insulted the late Imam. But they do not dare to do so because they know that the people will react harshly. So the enemies are after distancing, creating a rift between the people and the establishment. They want to manipulate people's thoughts. So the enemy is seeking economic pressure, then including the sanctions, and also mudslinging and spreading media lies, economic hostility, media hostility. The youths must resist all these. The nation must resist these moves by the enemy. Economic pressure must be nullified through domestic efforts and by nullifying the sanctions, and also efforts made in the field of diplomacy, as our dear brothers, revolutionary brothers, are active. They are seeking to nullify these sanctions, and they are working hard. So we should contribute to domestic production and domestic economic moves, the science-based economy, the science-based companies are important, and this must be developed. And also, the mudslinging and media propaganda by the enemies must be nullified. May God grant more blessings to the nation and make the nation successful. And salutations to the martyrs and salutations to the pure soul of the late Imam. And may God grant his mercy upon him. And I wish success and prosperity for the people and the people of Tabriz. I wish you success, and I also there was recitation of the Holy Quran, the song, and also the address by Mr. Ali Hashem, and the eulogy that was performed. I wish to thank you all. I wish you success and prosperity.
Welcome back, dear listeners. What you heard was the live coverage of the televised speech of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the occasion of the uprising of the people of Tabriz on February 18, 1978, against the Pahlavi regime. During this speech, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, Tabriz 1978 uprising contributed to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He added, Tabriz has played key role in resistance against tyranny in Iran's history. The leader of the Islamic Revolution said February uprising of Tabriz in 1978 paved the way for the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He said late Imam Khomeini boosted nation's morale by his guidance during revolution and imposed war. The leader of the Islamic Revolution said great martyrs, including General Soleimani, were inspired by Imam Khomeini's guidance and teachings. The leader added, continuation of revolutionary movement means attaining goals set by Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iranian nation has always acted vigilantly in critical situations, adding nation's massive turnout in recent Islamic Revolution anniversary rallies revealed its vigilance. The leader said enemies don't want our nation to gain success in peaceful nuclear energy area, adding that we should not permit current problems to overshadow main achievements of Islamic Revolution. The leader reiterated, we have made major breakthroughs since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, adding that Islamic Revolution is still alive and generative. The leader said enemies' hostility indicates our nation still remains faithful to Islamic Revolution. The leader said resistance front is growing fast in the region and more nations are saying no to U.S. hegemony. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei reiterated enemies are seeking to create division between the nation and Islamic establishment. And this was some parts of the speech of the leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, many thanks for being with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs. In the limelight.
The Uni Party's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. We now present you an article written by Ramin Mazahiri, the chief correspondent in Paris for Press TV. The piece is titled, US Elections Show Letdown in Biden Global, Not Just Domestic, 1 Year After. In speaking with Iranian immigrants to the United States, I always hear a couple of refrains repeatedly. One, why Democrats do not criticize their own politicians when they do the exact things they criticize Republicans for. And two, when Republicans get into office, at least they actually do things they say they want to do. Democrats never do. If an immigrant can pick up on this, why can't the American voters? An answer which is empathetic to the American voter was discussed in the very first column I wrote from the America for Press TV just after the 2020 US presidential election, back when the results were still allowed to be openly disputed. So just 3 days after the election, results are in. Duopoly wins. Trumpism wasn't a cult of personality. He added, "The biggest problem is something we tried to address in our coverage of the election from the start, the refusal of the world's oldest and strongest duopoly to allow third-party alternative voices to be heard, much less have some political or cultural power." Americans cannot pick up on these two ideas, which new arrivals can. And because they lack these two political insights, they foolishly expected Democrats to do something seriously different in 2021. Many are surprised at how far to the right Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have behaved since January of 2021, because conservatism, fiscal, political and foreign policy is the only policy allowed in what is truly a uniparty system, which is a direct result of the forced duopoly. Indeed, politically active Americans would rather rabidly shout at non-believers that the other side is on the side of the Satan, rather than to honestly discuss the obvious pattern of overwhelming similarities in the actions of Republicans and Democrats. Political reporting is far more interesting in France, where at least there's a multi-party system and proportional, not first-past-the-post, winner-take-all voting. To avoid discussions of such realities, the US media is paid to whip up the basest emotions over the most moral of public concerns and to treat elections like horse races for gambling. There is ruthless suppression of any sustained discussion of ideas which threaten the uniparty. The US government's seizure of PressTV.com domain last June during the Biden administration, not Donald Trump's, please note, stands as proof of both this sentiment and the fact of duopoly. We can't say that Americans aren't somewhat aware. A slim majority of America does prefer to classify themselves apart as independent. But they are powerless to stop the endless conservatism and reaction of the duopoly and uniparty. It has been said for over a century, because all working and middle-class people simply want morality in economic matters and fair justice in political matters, that the masses of the United States are far to the left of their workers. I've read the same thing from just as long ago about the French. The problem is clearly endemic in their political system, which is Western liberal democracy, which remains a fundamentally aristocratic, elitist, anti-revolutionary, inequality-perpetuating system. Who can be surprised that Democrats haven't reduced inequality, much less tried? The US Democrats, who claim to be progressives, are sending disgruntled messages via text or on Facebook. They must either be new in the United States, naive, hypocritical, or simply playing a role for others. But just as Donald Trump was a net positive because he revealed to even the most thick-headed or simply jingoistic people the glaring faults of Western liberal democracy, so too will the subsequent disappointment of the Democrats show many the light regarding the implacable reaction of the duopoly. It's almost as if Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi wanted to fail. Why did she wait so long to even bring to a vote an infrastructure package, which would have provided the campaign of Democrats with something tangible to show for 1 year of Bidenism? Much was made of the fact that campaigning Democrats were begging for this. negotiations took too long. Could Coral her own party? Or is it entirely possible that she wanted to ensure that there was no progressive component, something which the duopoly has always opposed? I refer to the laughable ideas, to those like myself who are surely quite cynical, to the committed US Democrat, that the United States 1% were going to pay for universal community college, paid vacations in France since 1936, and a host of other entirely sensible and moral ideas which have been quantifiably improving other nations around the world for decades already. The idea is that Nancy Pelosi wanted to delay and then to fail in order to have the minuscule progressive faction known as the Squad to blame, in order to, from this point forward, say that these progressive promises which Joe Biden made are simply not feasible from a political point of view, as it turns out that the people actually don't want these things per the losing votes. Of course, the duopoly run by the 1% wants progressives to fail. They have wanted this decade after decade. They've wanted it so very long, the US is now one of just 7 countries, most of the others are islands, without one day of maternity leave. Why did Democrats spend the last year pushing major educational reforms such as sex education classes for children? The false idea that the US was actually founded in 1619, when the first African slaves arrived, and other nonsense, rather than do one-tenth of what they campaigned on. The same answer makes the most sense. Democrats wanted to lose because their real policy is American duopoly ultra-conservatism. My post-election column stressed how, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump or Trumpism, the uniparty American system burned down whatever was necessary in order to get Trump out, precisely because he threatened the duopoly. Indeed, the only thing the US 1% wants, as much as progressives to fail, is to have gotten Trump out. Donald Trump, after all, changed his party affiliation 5 times, and was rejected by the Republican establishment as late as May of 2016. He's not a Republican, but Republicanism has, as the column also predicted, profited from him. This will allow the Republican elite and establishment to eventually dilute and soften Trumpism rather than giving America a true new start and somewhat revolutionary clean break. This is how effective the duopoly is when confronted with any grassroots movement. And this is also what has just happened. The victorious governor of Virginia was described by the New York Times as fleece-wearing, dad-like Trump in khakis. Republicans were always going to profit from the undeniable success of Trumpism. Republicans were always going to profit from the guaranteed U-turn of a Democratic Party, which held both the White House and the Congress. The duopoly was always going to continue cooperating among each other to enact law after law to make the rise of a third party harder and harder. The duopoly was always going to suppress media and force their media to inflame the moral sensibilities of many over nonsensical and needless issues. The subhuman policies of the United States towards Iranians were easy to try and pin on the seemingly subhuman Donald Trump, but it's a fact which requires no special political insight to note that they were the same policies of Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter. Those Democrats' policies were the same as Ronald Reagan, Bush the Elder, and Bush the Younger. It's a uniparty system masquerading as fair and balanced duopoly. The uniparty's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them a slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. Crush any progressive political ideas out of them, reduce them to chaos, and create unwanted dependency towards the US elite.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Tantura in cold blood. They were buried in mass graves, the largest of which is believed to be under a parking lot. The Tantura massacre and its aftermath is arguably the most glaring representation of the Zionist regime's criminality. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud, journalist and editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle. This article is titled, From Tantura to Naqab, Zionist regime's long hidden truths are finally revealed. Stay tuned for more. A succession of events in recent weeks all point to the inescapable fact that nearly 75 years of the Zionist regime's painstaking efforts aimed at hiding the truth about its origins and its current racially driven apartheid regime are failing miserably. The world is finally waking up. And the Zionist regime is losing ground quicker than its ability to gain new supporters or to whitewash its past or ongoing crimes. First, there was Tantura, a peaceful Palestinian village whose inhabitants were mostly exterminated by the Zionist regime's Alexandroi Brigade on May 23, 1948. Like many other massacres committed against unarmed Palestinians throughout the years, the massacre of Tantura was mostly remembered by the village's survivors, by ordinary Palestinians and by Palestinian historians. The mere attempt in 1998 by an Israeli graduate student, Theodor Katz, to shed light on that bloody event ignited a legal, media and academic war, forcing him to retract his findings. In a recent social media post, Israeli professor Ilan Pape revealed why, in 2007, he had to resign his position at Haifa University. Pape wrote, "One of my crimes was insisting that there was a massacre in the village of Tantura in 1948, as was exposed by MA student Teddy Katz. Now, some Alexandro Brigade veterans have finally decided to confess to the crimes in Tantura. They silenced it. It mustn't be told. It could cause a whole scandal. I don't want to talk about it, but it happened." These were the words of Moshe Diamant, a former member of Alexandre Brigade, who, with other veterans, revealed in the documentary Tantura by Alan Schwartz the gory details and the horrific crimes that transpired in the Palestinian village. An officer killed one Arab after the other with his pistol, Micha Victon, a former soldier, said. Another explained, "They put them into a barrel and shot them in the barrel. I remember the blood in the barrel. I was a murderer. I didn't take prisoners," Amit Zor Cohen admitted. Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Tantura in cold blood. They were buried in mass graves, the largest of which is believed to be under a parking lot at Dor Beach, flocked by Israeli families daily. The Tantura massacre and its aftermath is arguably the most glaring representation of Israeli criminality. However, this is not the story of Tantura alone. The latter is a representation of something much bigger, of mass-scale ethnic cleansing, forceful evictions and mass killing. Thankfully, much truth is being unearthed. In 1951, the Zionist regime's army launched a full-scale military operation that ethnically cleansed Palestinian Bedouins from the Naqab. The tragic sins of entire communities being uprooted from their ancestral homes were justified by the Zionist regime with the usual cliché that the terrible deed was carried out for security reasons. In 1953, the Zionist regime passed the so-called land acquisition law, which allowed the Israeli regime to seize the land of the Palestinians who were forced out of their homes. By then, the Zionist regime had unlawfully expropriated 247,000 dunams in the Naqab, with 66,000 remaining unutilized. The remaining land is currently the epicenter of an ongoing saga involving Palestinian Bedouin communities in the occupied territories and the Zionist regime, which falsely claims that the land is essential for the Zionist regime's development needs. Recently revealed documents uncovered by extensive research conducted by Professor Gadi Al-Ghazi points towards the Zionist regime's version of the truth in Naqab being a complete fabrication. According to numerous uncovered documents, Moshe Dayan, then head of the Zionist regime's Army Southern Command, was central to an Israeli regime and military ploy to evict Bedouin population and to revoke their rights as landowners, per the conveniently created Israeli law, which allowed the regime to lease the land of it if its own. There was an organized transfer of Bedouin citizens from the northwestern Negev, Iswad, to barren areas, with the goal of taking over the lands. They carried out this operation using a mix of threats, violence, bribery, and fraud, Al-Ghazi told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. In an interview with Agence France-Presse, Lemire stated that his book offers definitive written proof on the premeditation, planning and coordination of this operation, and that includes official meetings between Kolek, the commander of the Zionist regime's army, and another top regime officials. The story continues. More heartbreaking revelations and a well-integrated version of the truth are exposing long-hidden or denied facts. The days of Israel getting away with these crimes seem to be behind.